You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Darren Kaster, and I'm sitting in studio. It feels as if it was years ago.
Stefan.
Stefan Hostetter is back in studio. And in fact, just Stefan Hostetter. So it's going to be the Stefan show today.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I've always wanted the Stefan show.
Yeah. So we have a few news items today we're going to be going through. First of all, let me just say a couple things first before we get into for this week's content. First of all, we got a quiver, shall I say.
Quiver.
Full of email about some of the stuff from last week's show. And for anybody who emails us, just generally, but I will say just because we got such a torrent of email, which was somewhat expected, frankly, on last week's show, that unlike a year ago, I am now largely employed.
Oh, wow.
And have much less ability to answer emails. So you're not being ignored. As long as you were not, you know, screaming at me and hurling insults, you will be replied to, but please bear with us. We love hearing from you, where there just may be some delay. So let's start with that. With that as well, I also have a number of pieces we're going to be getting to at the end of the program, because a whole bunch of... Well, it's stuff we've talked about quite a bit, but I happen to have a whole bunch of brand new numbers in front of me. So we're going to be talking about just how absolutely... silly. I was about to say something I can't say on air, Stefan. How absolutely ludicrous, maybe there's a good word, all our subsidy of fossil fuels in this country is, what that does to our actual job market, what it actually does to our economy. It's not what you're told, I'll guarantee that. And the lost opportunities, we'll also roll that into some updates about what's going on, both in some updates in Alberta, which are very interesting, and some not so interesting or unfortunately interesting for the wrong reason, more silliness to be coming out of the BC climate stuff. So we'll be getting into climate policy, money, pipelines, and subsidies, which is kind of our go-to stuff. We're going to get to that at the end, but Stefan, I missed you.
Ah.
So you said you wanted to play a game, and I'm actually going to let you. We're going to start on a high note today, and I'll let you take the floor now.
All right. Thank you very much. The game actually is connected to a news story. So I'll start with the news story. It's a very brief news story, which is mostly just a segue into the game that I want to play. But the news story is that there are thousands of churches in the UK that are getting off fossil fuels. 3,500 churches, actually, which is a very small percentage of the 50,000 churches that exist in the UK. But it's a majority of the ones that are run by the Salvation Army, and a third of the Quaker meeting rooms. So it's like it's a certain number. It's a decent number. And of course, that comes on the heels to some extent, or not. Neither of those two technically actually think the Pope, you know, can talk to God, but there's at least the, but generally in the Christian faith, there is, you know, some connection, I think, at least.
They're on moderately good terms these days.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm sure some people, so now we get weird things from the Irish, but anyways, that's a whole different bag of worms.
Well, the point of the show is to anger at least somebody.
Okay. Well, great. Then we've already done a quota, and we have 54 minutes to spare.
So this is a great story. I'm really we don't often talk about the religion angle for the same reason we don't often talk about some of the stuff we talked about last week as well, having to do with sort of non-environmentally directly related geopolitics. But you know, as we always talk about, all this stuff is rolled into one. And with mine and yours personal beliefs aside, religion does play an incredibly large role in many people's lives. So this is an important issue, and we don't talk about it enough. So
yeah.
Thank you for picking that.
Yeah, yeah. So there's and of course that comes actually from another thing that the Pope called destroying the environment a sin, and one quote he has actually in this whole thing is that he says that just to make sure I'm not going to ruin my game here, let me read what I'm actually going to be doing. Okay, great. This part is not part of the game I'm about to play, but one of his quotes is that humanity mankind is turning the planet into a polluted wasteland full of debris, desolation, and filth. That's the Pope. That is a dark, dark comment for the Pope. Mm. Anyways, so which brings me to the game. The game is very simple. Mm. The game is called Pope or Marxist. and how the game works is I will read two different quotes. Mm. One is from the Pope, and one is from Marxist.com.
Mm.
And so what we'll do is I'll read two quotes. At the end of the show, I will reveal who is correct.
Oh, all right.
It'll be the two of you. Alex is in the booth in the tech, and of course you, Sarah and Darren. And then all the rest of you listening currently, I can tweet in your answers to my handle or the Green Majority. My handle's at STE. Steho, STEHO underscore, mm-hmm. And Green Majority is obviously at Green Majority, and they can try to beat the two of you on understanding this, which is one, which is which.
All right, so whose Marxist detector is the best, or Pope detector?
Exactly, yeah. Which one do you know better? So quote A, so A and a B. Let's go that relatively simply. Quote A is neoliberalism in the modern sense is only a mask that covers the ugly reality of the most rapacious exploitation. The destruction of the planet, the destruction of the environment, without the slightest concern about the fate of future generations. That's the first quote. That's quote A. Quote B is, yet there is an invisible thread joining every one of those forms of exclusion. Can we recognize it? These are not isolated issues. I wonder whether we can see that these destructive realities are part of the system which has become global. Do we realize that the system has imposed the mentality of profit at any price, with no concern for social exclusion or the destruction of nature?
Nice. I'm going to let Alex go first.
Also, no Googling for those of you at home.
Well, you can, but then you're cheating.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I choose which quote I think is the Pope and which quote I think is Marxist.
Yeah.
All right.
Or at least from Marxist.com. I don't need to anger all the Marxists saying maybe this quote isn't Marxist. I'm just reading Marxist.com.
Okay, I'm going to go with quote A, Marxist, quote B, Pope.
All right.
Interesting. I'm going to flip it. I think the first one was Pope, second one was Marxist.com.
All right. Okay, so everyone else out there on the ESphere, you have the next 40-ish minutes to make up your mind without Googling, and then you guys can break the tie. Which one of these is the Pope and which one is Marxist?
And if you're playing at home on the podcast, just pause the program.
Exactly. Yeah. So of course, all of this is love to ingest, but what I wanted to highlight there is just the level of which the rhetoric has been ramped up on the sort of the way the global system has been actually infringing on nature. Mm. And it's the fact that you're getting these incredibly people in incredibly high positions, and not positions that are normally, you know, the Pope has never really been, you know, has never really been a big voice for nature for quite some time. Mm. If ever, to the level extent that this current one is, of course. And so that's why I wanted to bring this up. It's one of those things where it's like, this is the level of which this is the, like, you know, people always argue about whether or not environmentalism is getting into the mainstream. Mm. I think the Pope's a little mainstream. I feel like he's relative
to other popes. He's the most mainstream in the history of popes. The fact that we can even have a conversation about him being marginally mainstream compared to like regular society—that's wow.
Yeah. Anyways, that's that story. But I got another one for you.
So do you have another? You have another quote you want to do?
No, that's it. We got one.
Okay. No. So I had a comment on that. Yeah. It has to do with discourse, and I think this is highly relevant with our you know, watching the just mind-bending, would love it if it was a movie, but it's scary because it's not American election right now, is that, you know, there's this thing where historically, this carries, you know, for lots of countries and for a lot of political discourse, but just, you know, speaking about the Americans for a second, the sort of quote-unquote right-wing was very successful over the last number of years, maybe 30 years, maybe longer, in essentially demonizing certain types of language. And the reason I think this is successful was, for instance, like the word progressive is even by people that, like, when you poll them, this has been done numerous times where you'll poll people on positions and then you ask them how they align politically, and their answers to the questions about what they think versus the label that they self-identify as has no bearing on each other whatsoever. And it's because, you know, certain elements have been able to poison certain words, right? And so historically in North America, communism has been a dirty word, but for the time being, at least, it's an imperfect line, but essentially, you know, you have communism or communalism. I think it might be more accurate. Communalism being sort of the ethos and communism being the political structure around that ethos, is, you know, sort of one end of a spectrum. And on the other end, we could say that we have, you know, free market economics, neoliberalism, and what I might deem as the idiom of, you know, what's mine is mine and, you know, go to hell with, you can go to hell. So what happens though, is if you poison one of those words where it's always bad, what you get is a just persistent drift to the other side of it, right? So when words like communalism and communism are, oh, those are dirty words, those are bad, we don't like those things, it doesn't just keep things where they are, it actively pushes them, because every time that something wants to go in one direction, there cannot be an opposition, because that opposition is wrong by definition. And that's what we have, right? So, you know, saying that, you know, we want to, you know, the Pope, regardless of which ones those quotes are, you know, the Pope is, as you're, you know, pointing out, is we're getting able to, the fact that we're able to find it difficult to discern between that and, you know, Marxist.com, is not a statement of, you know, that, you know, the Pope has lost his mind. It's that the current status in which we exist has drifted because of the successful negative ad campaign on certain types of words and certain types of language and certain types of labels, has allowed it to drift so extremely to one direction. That now I think that it's not that people are changing their minds about communism. It's that everyone's going, okay, all right. You know what? There's limits. Like, you know, like we've decided as a society that slavery is a limit. Well, every once in a while, those limits get updated. And I think we're under one of those things right now where people are sort of waking up and being like, okay, you know, yeah, I don't want to live in, you know, an American might say, I don't want to live in China or something like that. Even though they're happy to do lots of business with them. But, you know, but there, but hey, you know, we should have, there should be some limits to this. And well, I think we're just right on the edge of that right now, where people are going like, okay. Yeah, I didn't want to live under, you know, the USSR rule or whatever, you know, whatever political stuff, the red commie scare and all that either. But like, hey, come on, like there's got to be a limit here. And I think we're on that now. And I think that both explains your game, or the reason why we could play your game, and also is just a trend to keep an eye on. And actually, there's a related story, but I will tie in, but I can tie that in later.
Oh no, you tied it now. Did I?
Okay, so the other one that I had that sort of ties directly into that was a fantastic article, which essentially was just somebody who actually had the time to go and do the research to find backup for a point that I make regularly, just because that's what I feel is true. Someone actually went and did the work, so I feel vindicated. Nice. There's a great article. This will be my "I really recommend you read it for this week" article, which I usually try and pick one that I urge people to actually take a look at themselves. This one's called "Overwhelming Evidence That Guaranteed Income Will Work." And what's been done here is a number of studies involving extremely reputable agencies, a number of mainstream media, although I wouldn't always call them reputable, in certain cases. Like, it's one of those things where like they have a large incentive to not say yes to this. So when they even agree, then we're like, okay, it has to be glaringly obvious. But all sorts of international organizations here. And basically, a number of things, including a World Bank analysis of 19 studies as one example, found that simply giving poor people money alleviates poverty. And the reason that's even like, well, why are you even saying that? That sounds silly. But the large argument against things like a social safety net is that, well, if you just give people welfare, they're just going to go spend it on drugs and alcohol, and they're going to buy booze, and they're going to buy cigarettes. Well, it turns out that that's been extremely heavily studied. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen, because you know what? Those people are hungry, and they spend it on food. And then once they have food, they generally spend it to put themselves in a at least minimal safe living environment. And then largely what happens is people try and get educated and raise their social structure. Exactly the same thing that the quote-unquote pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, capitalist dream is supposed to be about, is what happens when you meet people's basic needs. And so I think what's really interesting here, I mean, we could spend a whole show going through all the data. In fact, I am going to flag this article, and we will come back at a future show, and when I have a chance to go through my Limits of series again, that we will go through the information here in quite more detail, because I think it's really, really interesting. There's been a number of tests and sort of trial runs of various forms of meeting people's basic needs and just seeing what happens. All of them point all in the same direction, which is that everybody wins. Crime goes down. General education goes up, people's living conditions go up, satisfaction with living, like everybody, not just the people that you funded, like society as a whole heals when people's basic income and needs are met. And that is also something that would, you know, 5 years ago, people would have been pulling their hair out, you know, trying to arrest you. Red commie. This is now, I mean, it's certainly not mainstream. This is an alternative news source. But the fact that many serious people are looking into this and going, oh, actually, you know what, it actually does kind of work, is hopeful. because yeah. I truly believe that this is the path to our salvation, if I can borrow some religious language there for a minute. We've got 3 minutes left in this segment, Stephen. Do you got time? Can you squeeze in your last thing?
Yeah, well, actually, the one I wanted to cover, I think I'll save to the end, because it's a two-parter.
Okay.
But unless, of course, we'll come back to the protest encampment in Cannonball River at the end of the show. But what I will throw in then actually is on the sort of topic of, you know, the slow change of our system, maybe back to something that makes more sense, is that Alberta passed a bill banning political donations from corporations and unions.
They did.
You know, it's widely accused of not being good enough, as all bills are.
But at the same time, important to note, it was voted for by members of all parties,
yeah.
including the PC party.
Yeah, so, exactly. So there's some hope. And it's one of those things where, of course, you know, the bill itself, you know, there's arguments about it's not going to do enough, all those sort of things. But anything that's sort of in that direction is so different from the direction we have been going for so long that it's a generally positive news story, I think.
And the funniest side is that even though that many all the parties voted for it, was that the Alberta Rose Party tried to take claim for the policy despite right. the fact that it was in the NDP platform before they existed. But yeah, sure. But I mean, what that's interesting is that, like, that's the thing, is that people, like, politicians know that these types of things are popular, but just nobody has the motivation. I was about to say another thing I can't say on air. Somebody has the motivation to do it, and as soon as he does, it's so damn popular that nobody can be seen. Like, I guarantee you a bunch of those conservatives that voted for did so sort of under, like, with their arms behind their back. And it's not because you know, somebody was putting pressure on them. It's because they knew, man, this is going to be really popular, and if I vote against this, I am screwed.
Well, and also they have a minority government, so the NDP could pass it no matter what.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, but like this, so they felt like they had to. But the other thing, like, so you have people now that would have never proposed this, and or even if they say they proposed it, you know. This has not been a real fight about this, and somebody comes in and does it, and then now all of a sudden everybody's falling all over themselves to take credit for it. Good on them. You know, we give people a pretty hard time, politicians a pretty hard time on the show. I think we have to be fair and say credit where credit is due.
Yeah, totally. Of course, the one thing I will note, along with the concerns about different loopholes that exist, which are, you know, just one thing about loopholes, I think, is that they're constantly so boring to actually try to explain that they are always just called loopholes, and that's the entire, and so no one ever actually understands what's actually going on. But what I want to talk about more specifically is that the individual donation limit remains at $15,000.
Yeah, that caught my eye too.
So it's not like this is a complete success. Like, to get, like, as what, like, most people don't have $15,000 to donate. And also, like, when you look at the concerns you still have getting money out of politics, part of it is that the people who actually donate are so commonly people. You, even if you donate $400, you get $300 back in a tax receipt or something like that. You get, like, 75% back of the first X amount you donate. But you need that up front money. So there's still, like, as much as a lot of these pieces are it's a great, like, it's a great direction to go, there's still definitely a thing where it's like, there's still, like, if I can give you $15,000, I'm not also, you know, I'm not making 30. You know, I'm not making a lower middle class wage to and then giving you $15,000.
Yeah. And so I think we'll take our break here. But I think that the last thing I want to say about that is if you want to go one step farther and really make this stick, here's what you do. And I know this might even be controversial even with our audience. Mm. One of the other ways in which people are bought off is by, you know, you don't give them a dime, but you let them know privately or imply it heavily that they're going to get a job when they're done. This is a big problem with the revolving door between major corporations, oil companies. And I mean, how many stories in the last few weeks have we talked about? About people rotating between boards of, you know, regulatory boards and the companies that they're supposed to be regulating.
You mean like Stephen Harper, Canada's newest, he moved into consulting, I think.
Yeah. Well,
I'm sure that'll be,
so here's the thing. Here's the thing. And I wonder how my idea will fare with our audience here, which is that guaranteed minimum income also should apply to all former politicians, and they are now going to be paid by the state a reasonable, fair wage for the rest of their lives, and they will be put in, maybe they can be hired in other forms of public service. Essentially, they're now in public service. Mm. They cannot be ever hired, contracted, used as some sort of bargaining chip, nothing. We have to close the door where they can never be rewarded later for their time, for their decisions while they were in office. And while we're busy pulling everybody up out of poverty and offering them a minimal living income, the politicians should get the same living income, and boy, would that number get real high real real fast. So why don't we stop it there? Go ahead.
One quick thing, just because I think it's funny. but you want to give people who you want to give former politicians and a bunch of money consistently for the rest of their lives for doing very little. I thought we were the Senate for that.
Yeah.
Senate well, burn.
We need to have triple the Senate seats. So what we're going to do after the break, we're going to come back and Emma Ma, one of our very appreciated volunteers who has not been able to make it into the program for a while, we played an interview that she did down at Common Bound, which is an interesting conference that was in Buffalo earlier in July. We have another interview from her on that, so I'll preview it right before we play it when we come back from break. But we're coming back to a very interesting interview done by Emma Ma with Denise Fairchild from the Emerald Cities Collaborative from the 2016 Common Bound Conference. Don't go away. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM on one of our very appreciated and wonderful Radio Syndicate partners, Rabble.ca, and of course the extended podcast version right here at greenmajority.ca. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. All right. Well, I'm super chilled out. Stefan, how are you feeling?
I'm asleep.
No, it was good. It was very soothing. Yeah. I appreciate that. It also contrasts very well with the dance music I played last week because I didn't have Alex here. So what am I to do? All right. So what we're going to do now is listen to an interview from. Oh, I should also say, if you're just tuning in, this is The Green Majority.
Yes, it
I'm
is.
Your host, Darren Kastner. Stefan Hostetter in studio. Alex Ricci in the tech room over there. And what we're going to do now is listen to a volunteer who's not here, but greatly missed. And so just because I wanted to hear her voice, I missed her so much. We're going to listen. No, it's a great interview. We're going to listen to Emma Ma interview Dr. Denise Fairchild, who's the president and CEO of Emerald Cities Collaborative. This was recorded at the 2016 Common Bound, which is the by the new Economy Coalition. Sorry, Common Bound by the New Economy Coalition Conference, which I think is fairly self-explanatory. We'll talk about it a little bit more when MA gets back as well. But without ado, let's listen to the interview. It's about, I'll let them explain it largely, but essentially we're talking about working with corporations, sometimes with a little bit of arm twisting, to get them to rethink their business models in a way that does not destroy the planet and does help some folks that need it, some disadvantaged segments of our economy, and trying to create some equality in the economic system. So we'll leave it there and let Emma take it away.
My name is Denise Fairchild.
All right, so let's get started. So I'll just I'll hold this up to me, and then when I ask you questions, then I'll sort of point it at you.
Okay.
So I'm with Denise Fairchild, who's the executive director of the Emerald City Collaborative. And Denise, I've just been in a session where you've spoken, and I found the work on the Emerald City Collaborative very interesting. So I wonder if you could actually just tell us a little bit about the Emerald City Collaborative, including what the origin of the name is and what it means.
Thank you very much. My name is Denise Fairchild. As the executive director of Emerald Cities Collaborative, we're a national organization. We are in 10 metropolitan areas in the United States. And we focus on building a sustainable, just, and inclusive economy and how to actually dismantle the extractive economy, the fossil fuel economy, and build a clean, sustainable economy. And we do this in coalition. So we work with labor, community organizations, grassroots groups, and businesses, and government. And in that process, rebuilding both the demand and supply side of the energy sector to be more just, more inclusive, more sustainable.
And you had spoken a little bit about our adaptability and culture and the impact of different systems. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Great. Well, part of the big vision of getting to an Emerald Cities is to understand how to get there. And the process of arriving there really has to do with understanding the culture that has supported the extractive economy and how we need to change our culture to be able to build a different kind of society. Cultural anthropologists say that culture is the most important tool that we have for adaptation. It is what is going to allow us to survive. It's what's going to permit us to be able to eat and support our family and rear our children. And so part of understanding culture is understanding it's about the our social relationships and how we work with each other and how we treat each other. It's about our ideologies and mode of thought about what's important and what's not important. And so in a Western culture, in a Western value system, you know, money is important and private property is important and materialism and consumerism is important and the rights of communities are disregarded. So that kind of cultural system is what is part of the problem that has gotten us to this existential crisis that we're in, where we're facing climate change and all of our environment is being destroyed. And so part of the change for the future is refocusing our culture, because that is how we're going to adapt into this new climate future.
And you gave a very nice concrete example around building solutions. And I understand that your work involves some multi-sectoral collaborations. And you'd given this example of some work that was being done in Seattle around supporting some low-income households to engage in a retrofit program. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. Well, part of the sort of the transition between understanding the cultural underpinnings of our economy and what needs to change is understand that we have to also change the institutions that are supporting the sort of the Western value system. And so it's our financial system, it's our educational system, it's our workforce infrastructure, it's our anchor institutions, our health institutions. All of these folks have bought into principles and practices of the Western culture. And so what Emerald Cities does is actually bring a lot of these institutions to the table. And we let them know that they are part of the problem. And we let them know that their future is dependent on working together with community groups, grassroots groups, to create something better and different. And allowing them to see their own self-interest in being able to build a sustainable future. So an example of that is where we have been working in Seattle through our coalition, and have been able to bring the utility sector to the table, as well as the State Housing Finance Agency, and be able to create a whole new financing system and a platform, as we call it, to allow low-income communities of color and nonprofit housing developers to retrofit their buildings, to make them energy efficient, to actually provide for clean energy options for a community that has been left out of the energy revolution. And that's putting new tools into the table, which is for municipal utility, they said they're going to provide on-bill financing. So that means that you don't, as a low-income person, need to take money out of your pocket. It also means that for large projects, multifamily housing, they're low-interest loans that Housing Finance Agency is providing. And they're doing it in a way that doesn't require security or collateral, which is like unheard of. And so to get 2% interest money, and it's not, you know, secured against your deed of trust, and to be able to pay, not have any money come out of your pocket to get the building retrofitted or to get solar, and to just pay it back as, you know, amortized over your bill, that's huge, to the point where prior to putting, you know, these institutions to bring them to the table and getting these new tools, you know, maybe there'd be one house here and one house there. Right now, we've got 3,500 units of affordable housing in the pipeline, ready to be able to access this new financing and utility program that is a direct result of engaging these institutions to rethink how they're doing business.
And that's a great step for inclusion, because I think we see many examples where you might hear of these shiny new programs that sound great, but they're really only available or accessible to middle and high income homes. And so the work you're doing is really extending that to people who would not perhaps otherwise have access. One thing you spoke about, too, is really building capacity in a new generation and you know, really working with young change makers. Do you want to share a little bit about that work?
So the part of sort of reclaiming our community institutions and changing how these institutions are doing business and the values that they hold is also looking at our community colleges and the role that they can and should be playing in building a different economy and to training the next generation to understand with the tools to be able to change, to be change agents. And so we have a program. It's through the Community Learning Partnership, and they're organizing networks in 7 cities, from Jackson, Mississippi, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to Los Angeles and New York and the Bronx, that are actually involving community organizers in establishing community change programs, providing experiential learning opportunities for young and sometimes not so young communities of color about social justice and economic justice and environmental justice, and letting them understand that, you know, that they are important to creating this new sustainable future, and giving them the tools and the skills for being able to do this. One of the things that we see right now is community colleges have basically have become tools of industry. You know, they're training our young people for jobs, to be able to work for the man, for the system, and so they're training young people to support the extractive economy. What the pendulum has swung, because that's not what community colleges were historically designed to do. They were historically designed to change, to create civic actors instead of just economic actors. How do you train people to be informed, capable civic actors? And that's what we're trying to do, is move that pendulum back from being just about economic actors to being civic actors. And there's a organization that we partner with, the Democracy Commitment, where 123 community colleges have made a pledge to begin to rebuild their institution to provide community change opportunities, reinstating liberal arts into this educational system that they have. One of the important things to note is a book is out now called Dark Money, and it really is about the story of the billionaires that have taken over, working to take over the minds of young people and the economy. And they have established, this is like the Koch brothers, they have established a law and economy course, and they have put them in every Ivy League institution in the United States, the Yales and the Harvards, and they're giving professors money to really train the captains, the future captains of industry, around their philosophy about privatization, anti-government, low taxes. And so you're taking these young minds and they're shaping them towards this conservative agenda. We have to be in this battle with comparable tools. And our young people of color are not necessarily in four-year institutions like Ivy League schools, but we're in the community colleges. And those community colleges need to be in service of our ideas of economic, social, and environmental justice.
So you're building a counter-movement, which we hope will become the main movement in terms of building these new systems, empowering young people, and as you said, not-so-young people, to build this new economy, this new future. And, you know, what I found really inspiring is that you're tackling this on a number of fronts. So you're tackling the systems issues, but you're also bringing a lot of different folks to the table in a constructive process. If you could leave me with one final thought in terms of the importance of sharing your work. You're here with me at Common Bound 2016 here in Buffalo. What do you think is the importance of coming together like this and sharing these kinds of initiatives?
Well, thank you. Common Bound conference has been an important venue for cross-fertilization of ideas. The issue is that we're all struggling. We're all in the struggle together. And that we're struggling in our individual cities, whether it's rural communities or major urban areas. We're working in different sectors. People working on gentrification issues, and people working on energy issues, and people who are trying to build co-ops. And we've got to take this to scale. And if we're going to take this to scale, we've got to share knowledge. We've got to figure out the shortcuts. And if you've been there and if you've done that, then you need to tell me so that I don't have to start from scratch. And so these kinds of places are important for the long struggle ahead, and so that we can accelerate the process and take it to the scale that we need to take it. I think it's really interesting that we're also doing it in Buffalo. As an African-American woman and someone who is, you know, very steeped in the history of my people and that of slavery, and knowing that Buffalo and Canada, we're at the place where the abolitionists were central to creating, dismantling the slave economy and building, or at least dismantling the slave economy. I'm not sure that we built anything better. But the point is, it's the same kind of struggle that we're in right now. You know, that the abolitionist, the emancipation effort was 100 years. It was long-term. It took many people from many sectors. It was black and it was white. We had to change the Constitution. We had to change the institutions that supported, our religious institutions that supported slavery and the slave economy, and our legal system and our educational system were all organized around the slave economy. Being in Buffalo makes you very clear that this is the same struggle that we're dealing now to dismantle the fossil fuel economy. It's going to take that same level of multi-sector engagement and collaboration is national and is global and is local, and it's just a great place to be.
Thank you so much for speaking to me. This is Denise Fairchild, Executive Director of the Emerald City Collaborative, here with me in Buffalo, and I want to wish you all the best with your inspiring work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Great interview. And thank you again for MA for providing us with that. You can learn more about Emerald Cities and Denise as well. We'll have links up on the website so you can check them out. That's the second or third time I've heard that interview. I have to say, every single time we get to that last part when she's like, oh, you know, we just dismantled the slave economy and then what? Okay, well, we may not have done anything better, but man, brutal. I mean, completely freaking accurate, it's just like, yeah, I like people hearing that, because, you know, one of the reasons why I like doing the show is because, like, listening to the mainstream media nauseates me so much. And one of it is like the overly sort of, you know, inoffensive language, to the point that, like, you muddle something down to that it almost doesn't mean anything anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. Once you say something in a way that makes everybody happy, that it doesn't mean anything. And it fills me with joy, and I can't help but laugh. Not because it's funny, but I can't help but laugh with sort of happiness. Like, yes, when you finally hear somebody sort of speaking truth and not censoring themselves and just saying what they think, it's just so damn refreshing. So thank you so much for that as well. So Stefan, we're going to take a very quick second and final music break. You're going to come back and tell us a little bit more news. We'll find out who won, whether Alex or I, and which of our listeners won your little game there as well, with some other news stories coming right back up after this break. Alex, what is our second and final music break?
All right. This is
All right. Thank you, Alex. I love that too. That was good. Great picks. Love having you back for many reasons. One of them is that your music taste is great. Thanks, buddy. So we're in the final segment here. You're listening to The Green Majority. I am your host, Darren Kaser, sitting in the studio with Stefan Hostetter and, of course, Alex Ricci, who's our tech this week. And we have a number of things we want to get through now, and we're starting to run tight on time. So let's get right to it, Stefan.
Yeah, thank you. This is a quick update on the ongoing pipeline protesters in North Dakota of the Cannonball River. Which is 50 miles due south of Bismarck, North Dakota, which is one of those things where it seems like I'm telling you something, but you probably also know where Bismarck is, or North Dakota necessarily. So I might just be saying a bunch of other words that don't necessarily give you any more information. However, the actual protest continues. It's been going on since April, and it's to block a $3.7 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. I know we talked over this in previous shows, but I feel like it's one of those things where it's like, I want to keep reminding people it's happening, because I think when these encampments, so it's actually a protest encampment with a shocking 90 different Native American tribes, nations and tribes have presence there, which is just such a massive confluence of different cultures and people to come together to fight this one thing, and it seems as if they're coming in from, they are actually coming from all across America to support these people in this one land. And I feel like it's very easy, I think, for us to forget that these things are ongoing. Because when there's no news except that they're still blocking it, it's very easy for us to forget that this is work. They are this is their lives. There's 500 to 1,000 people living semi-permanently blocking this pipeline right now. And these are people who they took out time out of their Sunday to go protest to do a protest march something like that. These are people who've taken now months out of their life to go stop to block this. And there are people who out there who have, in other places have done years to fight these sort of battles and continually shown us that the amount of which First Nations and Aboriginal peoples are consistently on the front lines of these fights. The one little tidbit from this article I actually really quite liked was that the people in the encampment speak of these two different prophecies that date back to the 1890s. And a leader called Black Elk foretold that in seven generations, the Native American nations would unite to save the earth. And then a second legend predicts that a Zuzeka snake, a black snake, would threaten the world. And for many of the protesters, the pipeline is that black snake.
Take that, Nostradamus.
Yeah. And they are the seventh generation. This is one of those things where it's like, you know, to see this kind of, I guess, this kind of environmental protection as your calling to that level, to that extent, mm-hmm. is what is necessary, I think, for us to actually see the shift we need. This is still ongoing, and we'll keep covering it as more information continues to come out. Mm-hmm. Of course, a few days ago, last week, on the 24th, a federal judge in Washington delayed the ruling over whether or not they were actually allowed to even be there. But of course, that's not the point. It's one of those things where it's like, yes, that'd be sweet if the judge got inside, but they're not really, you know, they're not there because the state lets them be there.
That's right.
But anyway,
should they be.
Yes, that's the update.
So I have six stories, and I'm going to do it in 8 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm going to go for a record here.
All right.
Okay, so I have a bunch of stories, and I'm going to string a narrative. This is one of the things I like to do on the show, which is everyone, I assume, who listens to the show is more than likely, I would say, greater than at least 51%, are able to read. Hmm. So I'm not going to read the news to you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to create a narrative for you. Huh. I like doing this. So here we go. Six stories in 8 minutes. So the NEB is postponing Energy East hearings after some apparently violent protests broke out in Montreal. They're being delayed. I don't currently have a date in front of me for when they're going to be reset, but we had about 100 protesters outside, and it resulted in three protesters being arrested, two people facing charges of obstruction and assault against a police officer. The point of the story here is, of course, is that the NEB is considered by many to be a completely owned subsidiary of the oil companies and simply doing their bidding on the government's behalf to provide cover. So this will continue because a lot of people have been paying attention to this. The story has been getting traction, and big ups to National Observer for covering it. Moving on. Canadian taxpayers also fork out $3.3 billion every year to support the profitable oil industry. This is a massive number. This is an updated number as well. Despite the fact that Trudeau promised that he would completely phase out all fossil fuel subsidies over the midterm while making it an election promise, we've yet to see any progress on this whatsoever of any meaningful type other than, yeah, we really promise we'll get to that. So what does that mean? Well, also in BC, their climate plan, which we tore up a little bit last week as well, includes subsidies for fossil fuels as well. So what's really interesting here is that 80% of the power produced by the Site C Dam, which is another environmental disaster that was unnecessary as well, that was being pushed through, 80% of that energy is precisely what some of these new LNG programs that are trying to be subsidized and pushed forward is through. And so I'm going to make the claim that it's at least possible. I don't have inside knowledge. It is at least possible that the entire reason why this horrible, horrible premier is pushing through a energy project called the Site C Dam, for which many experts have said is absolutely unnecessary, was simply to provide a quote-unquote renewable resource of power to provide cover for the liquid natural gas projects that she's really in love with and has decided to subsidize in their climate plan. Story three, civil society is not taking this lying down. We have a new campaign by a wide variety of the large NGOs in this country who are going to be pushing on Trudeau to commit to ending all fossil fuels in Canada by 2020. You can learn more about that on the website and get involved or sign a copy of the open letter petition.
read it, share it with your friends. Now, why is this important? Because Oil Patch to Solar Field is another story we're covering by DSmogBlog here, and it's talking about how there's so many folks who are oil-trained professionals in Alberta looking for retraining in solar industry that there's not enough spots, and there's such a boom of interest in the industry, both from a training and from an investment point of view, that there's a lot of concern that Canadians are going to lose out on renewable energy job opportunities because they're not being trained fast enough, and there's so much demand that they're going to be bringing in experts from other countries. So there go all those good, high-paying Canadian jobs we were supposed to be have in the oil companies. Oh, wait, no, I mean in the solar industry. And so now not only are we going to have solar anyway, but we're going to waste $3.3 billion a year subsidizing companies, which goes right, add that to your price at the pump, folks, that you pay for that. You just pay for it in a different space. It's like the difference between your taxes and paying on the TTC fare. You're still paying for it. It's just a hidden cost because it gets rolled in with your income tax and all sorts of other stuff. So that is still the price of oil, not even covering all the future damage it's going to do. People want these jobs. They're not getting them. Now, why is that important? Well, because we have yet another story of where solar is now surpassing the price of coal to the degree that in Chile, they are now producing so much solar energy at such an incredibly low cost, they're now going to be not in need of any coal whatsoever, and will now begin selling solar power generated energy at an enormous profit to surrounding countries because they're drowning in that liquid gold sunshine.
Mm. Wow.
There we go.
Well, you did that in like four.
Well, there we go. I was going double fast. So the overview is that we're essentially looking at the continuance of a ton of money for things that we don't need. The alternatives that are better both for our economy and for our workforce and for the environment are being ignored, and those opportunities are going to go other places. So let's get on Justin Trudeau if he wants to think about his legacy and what does not want to be considered by people more than just me as Harper with shinier smile. He's going to have to get on this, and he has the biggest opportunity to do so in the world because it's actually just completely irresponsible and stupid from every possible point of view, including an economic one, not to. So what more motivation do you need?
Mm. There you go. Well done. I was thinking of things earlier, actually. A small soundboard of a few noises. If I had an applause button right there, I'd give you applause.
I was actually thinking about the one from Anchorman where he goes, "That got out of hand really fast. You should probably lay low for a little while." I'm sure we could use that soundbite regularly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or the escalated quickly one.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, then I will jump back in and announce the winner of the competition.
We have a winner.
Yeah, we have a winner. Drum roll, please. Again, drum roll. That would be great. Thank you. It is Alex Rigi, everybody. Alex Rigi was correct.
I am the loser.
So I'm going to, and for all the fun, I'm just going to reread the Pope's quote. Just so all of you know, the Pope said this, which is... yet there is an invisible thread joining every one of these forms of exclusion. Can we recognize it? They are not isolated issues. I wonder whether we can see that these destructive realities are part of a system which has become global. Do we realize that the system has imposed the mentality of profit at any price with no concern for social exclusion or the destruction of nature? And what I want to highlight here is the Pope is also getting at with something else that we don't talk about too much on the show, in part because it's difficult to, which is the fact that a sustainable world is like it's very easy to talk about things like localism, and it's very easy to talk about things like all of these things that we need, right? It's very easy to talk about like, oh, we need to start sharing more things and all this sort of stuff. And this ties into something that I want to bring onto the show during the fall session, which is an idea I've been teasing for months, but I think I'm actually going to sit down and actually write something on it this weekend, which is about this idea of the need for environmentalists to plan to win. Mm. Emma and I talked about this forever, and so at some point I'm going to write something about this soon. I think Emma and I might sit down and actually really hammer out a larger piece of this. Mm. But the idea basically being that while we are still pushing the government to get you know actually useful carbon prices and all these other sort of things, what we need to start doing as environmentalists is to start creating the system that. Creating the networks and the systems underneath our current system so that can take the burden off what will inevitably come down. Mm. What I mean by that is that if a strong carbon price, which has been noted all the time, done relatively in almost any way without any any supports for lower income people is a regressive tax. A carbon tax or a present carbon, it will hurt the more disenfranchised more because they don't have the money to be able to fund it. And the idea of consumer goods, as they get more expensive, will disproportionately hurt the people who need the small amount of consumer goods. And so part of the environmentalist plan, I think, has to be creating this network of things like the Toronto True Library and a sharing economy. Things like local food co-ops that allow you to work and get fresh food that way. And we need to start finding and creating these systems that in place that can actually allow us to be more local than we are now. Like right now, it's almost impossible to buy things, to be totally local. It's almost impossible. And as much as I think there's still this idea that, it's funny because environmentalists are so commonly both simultaneously globalists in that we are one world, but localists in saying, but you should probably eat the thing right behind you rather than the thing from Panama. And we have to hold these two tensions in our hands at the same time. And I think so. That's what is interesting. The Pope's here message here is that really that what we see when you export when you're importing so many stuff is you miss all the impacts of where it's actually being created. Mm-hmm. And this is a central problem that also exists within cities. Is that when cities say that they're going to go carbon free or anything like that, they are talking about scope 3 emissions, which is emissions that are basically directly happen inside the city. Mm-hmm. And of course, the problem with that is you could be a completely 100% renewable energy or renewable city in scope 3 emissions. You could have only solar panels inside your city. You could do all that sort of stuff. But if you're still importing all of the stuff you consume, all you're doing is exporting the emissions somewhere else.
Including the solar panels and the food and the
even the renewable energy itself, we're exporting the emissions to build these renewable technologies. And so I think what we need to start having is a larger conversation about is how we can get down to the hard part of actually building a sustainable society outside of this constraints we see so consistently within the globalized system that is so consistently proven to have these difficulties.
Yeah, and the other thing too, there was something very interesting which actually stuck with me that was said. So I was doing a local event. Actually, I think I was speaking at some local event, and a local activist, part of the No Line 9 folks here in Toronto, who I bumped into a number of times, sent me. We chatted with him, and he ended up sending me an email. And the beginning of the email, it was a whole bunch of ideas about certain different ways to organize society. But it was the way that he opened the email actually that I remember more vividly than the actual content, because it was a bunch of interesting ideas. But there's lots of ideas. But the thing was, the ideas that was outlining, I believe it was a quote by somebody, probably a Marxist, frankly,
or the Pope,
saying something about when society fails, when an idea that runs a society fails or something like that, it will grasp for the nearest one at hand to replace it. Hmm. And that is why it's important, even my brother, I'm going to pick on him because I don't think he's listening, has, sometimes been like, oh, well, that pie in the sky, futurism, everybody's technology, blah, blah, blah. That's a waste of time. That's not going to happen in my immediate future. And so it's useless. And he actually finds it kind of annoying to talk about this stuff. Fair enough. That's his point of view. But this is why it's important. The thing is that, we have to talk about the world we want and how that would work. And I think it is important to have these discussions. And even if there's no clear path to how we'll get to that right away, to have these discussions, because maybe it will happen over time. But also B is to make the case about how the systems we have now are they're not under threat from annoying activists, because if that's the only threat that people see is that, well, you're going to get complained if you do this, the attitude is, well, yeah, but you'll never give up that stuff, right? So it's people doubt people's sincerity and how far they're willing to go for these things. And so I think what we really need to do, while we do keep up pressure big up to all the activists who are First Nations and Indigenous folks who are collecting in North Dakota, but it's also to talk about how the system endangers itself and how we're just pointing out that it's a bad system that's going to devour itself and collapse anyway, and we're simply asking for a plan to replace it when it does. But it's not like capitalism that in its current form is not going to collapse because of a bunch of angry activists. It's going to collapse because it's eating itself. And we're simply trying to warn the alarm bell and saying, hey, maybe we should pull a chute before we hit the ground. I just looked up. It's 11:59, Stefan. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Nice to see you as well. Alex, thank you so much for seeing us. We're going to be back with the bonus show if you're listening to the podcast. Other than that, thank you for enjoying this week's edition of the Green Majority Radio Program. See you all next week. Take care.